Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me to start this episode off right is Brendan Duke. He is an economic guru of things that involve numbers here at the Center for American Progress. And he's also been working overtime on the new overtime rule. Promised you a pun, Brendan. I did. So thank you for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Rebecca.
Are you still glad to be here, even though I opened with that pun?
I'm expecting 5 to 6 more.
Challenge accepted. So before we even get into what the rule does, help us understand, how does overtime work? If I'm a worker in America and I, work more than some number of hours a week, don't I just get paid time and a half? Isn't that just how it works?
So I think a lot of people don't understand how overtime works because the rules have been so weak and so laxly enforced that for a lot of workers, they may as well not have existed. So let me go into basically the framework for understanding whether you get overtime. So first of all, overtime is you get paid time and a half for each hour you work over 40 hours. So that 41st hour, you should be getting paid extra for getting paid. And the key thing is you should be getting paid. In a lot of cases, when people don't get paid overtime, they don't get paid any more for that extra hour of work. So how do you know whether you qualify for overtime? So there's a three-step process. The first step is, are you paid on an hourly basis? If the answer is yes, you are entitled to overtime when you work more than 40 hours a week. The second question is your salary level, which is the issue that we're going to be discussing right now. Currently, if you make under $26,000 a year, or about $455 per week.
And those are for people who are not working hourly. These are the salaried workers.
Precisely, for salaried workers, exactly. Then they get overtime. Now, if you make over the $26,000 under current law, you still actually can get overtime. It's just a question of whether you fall into this complicated thing called the duties test, which is very hard to enforce. It's whether you are a professional, it's whether you are a manager, and this is where a lot of the shady stuff has happened with the law, and that's why a lot of people who, study overtime really care about the salary threshold, because it is a guarantee, it is the easiest thing to enforce. Determining whether or not somebody's a manager or professional, that's pretty difficult. Determining whether somebody makes $26,000 a year is pretty easy, and that's why we've been focused on that.
So why has shady stuff happened, and what is this shady stuff?
Well, one thing about capitalism is that employers definitely have an incentive to save money. And that's one thing they do is they try to move people. They try to not pay overtime if they don't have to. That's why we have the rule.
It costs money. Right?
It costs money.
Right.
It puts, or it forces them to have to hire another worker. Mm-hmm. And the key thing is that when these workers work over 40 hours a week and they don't get the time and a half, they don't even get paid more. And that's the key thing, is that this labor is free to the employer. That your employer can actually require you to work as many hours as they wish. You could leave the job, but at that salary, they can ask you to work as many hours as they wish. Overtime is a way to, kind of price that in and make sure you get paid extra for extra work.
So why did we need this new rule? Was the previous policy on overtime not doing a good job of figuring out who should actually get paid overtime and how much?
So, overtime has been part of federal law since the 1930s. It was the same law that established the federal minimum wage. The problem with both is they weren't pegged to inflation. Prices rise, 1 to 2% a year. And if you don't raise things with inflation, they become meaningless. Now, the minimum wage, it requires congressional action to do, and we haven't been raising it nearly as much as we should be, but we've raised it fairly regularly. The last time it went up was back in 2009. Overtime, the beautiful thing about overtime is that it just requires the president to do. It doesn't require an act of Congress, which is amazing with this Congress. But
for some people, yeah. You and I might feel it's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing for you and I and American workers.
As we'll get into later, Paul Ryan might not think it's amazing.
Exactly.
Right.
Though that also gets into, a president who doesn't believe in overtime could actually overturn the regulation too. So it cuts both ways, actually. So the president can do it themselves, but it's not automatically pegged to inflation, or at least it hasn't been. And so the crazy thing is that between 1975 and today, It was only raised once back in 2004. That was under the Bush administration. And it was an inadequate raise. The key thing is that the last raise before Bush was under that radical liberal Gerald R. Ford, who raised it to about $50,000 per year was the overtime threshold when you adjust for inflation back in 1975. So really what it's about is just kind of maintaining the standard we had back in the 1970s.
So what has the standard now, this salary threshold, which is what you're talking about, what has that been raised to with the overtime rule that was released earlier this week?
So it's been raised to $48,000 a year. It was going to be raised to $52,000, but there were some complaints from employers and people who are and lobbyists who are basically paid to oppose giving workers a raise. That's their job. And so it was brought down to $48,000 a year, which is not quite the 1975 level, but it's pretty darn good and far better than the $26,000. And the other key thing that's happening is this problem should actually go away forever because it is pegged not to inflation, but to wage growth. So it is pegged to, it's a little bit complicated. This is how deals work. It is pegged to the 40th percentile wage in the Southern United States, because that is the area of the country with the lowest wages and the slowest wage growth. And so that was based on a concern that this is a federal policy and, you know, it's too much in the South. So they just brought it down to the 40th percentile wage in the South.
Well, so you bring up the South, which actually is maybe an interesting segue into talking about, so who's going to be helped by this new overtime rule? I think a lot of folks have been using the number 12.5 million workers. That's a lot of workers who are potentially going to benefit. But who are they? And you mentioned the South. Are there certain demographics or geographic regions in this country that are going to disproportionately be affected?
So the overtime threshold really comes into play for not the lowest wage workers, but the workers who are just kind of above the minimum wage and getting well into the middle class. Because, you know, the key thing is $48,000 a year. Let's keep in mind, this is wages, not incomes. So you could actually have two people who work full time who make $96,000 a year who are affected by this salary. So this actually gets into, by any definition, the middle class. So it kind of affects that group of, you know, just above low wage to middle class. And, you know, so that's kind of where it hits. It's about even between men and women. I think it's basically all over the country. It's 12.5 million. It's a ton of people, all sorts of demographic groups. It's going to be a big deal for millennials. It should actually hit about 5 million millennials, which is a huge deal because, you know, as we've done research at CAP showing that millennials get paid the same as baby boomers did 30 years ago when you adjust for inflation, even though they're far more educated, even though the economy's gotten far more productive. So this is going to make a big deal for young workers today.
And the Economic Policy Institute, EPI, which has done some work breaking down kind of, you know, who's going to be helped, they point out that actually, while, as you point out, raising this threshold is going to affect workers in all states, it's going to have the biggest effects in really basically southern states, right? They name West Virginia, Arkansas, South Carolina, Tennessee. Is there a reason that we think that those types of states are disproportionately home to workers who will benefit from this kind of a policy?
You know, I just kind of guessing right now. It's because this is kind of that low to mid range. And I think that, you know, wages tend to be, that's a big portion of the, you know, southern workforce is that low to middle class range. So I think that's a big part of it is that they tend, you know, those, you know, a state like West Virginia actually tends to be actually fairly equal because they don't have the Michael Bloombergs and the Bill Gateses of the world. So I think that's a big part of the reason why is because wages tend to be lower there. And so everybody tends to be affected.
So I mentioned Paul Ryan before. He declared earlier this week that he would fight tooth and nail. I'm paraphrasing, but that's how it sounded, to stop this overtime rule in its tracks. Now, that, of course, coming on the heels of multiple years of his claiming to be the great savior of low-income and struggling Americans. So I will, you know, highlight his comments with not a small amount of snark. Why are conservatives, and it is really conservatives, but also employers, potentially not huge fans of this new rule?
Because it puts money in the pockets of workers, and, you know, that comes from employers' profits. So this is a policy that kind of reverses the redistribution of wealth or income, rather, that we've had over the past 40 years, going from middle class and low wage workers to employers, because we haven't, you know, adjusted the overtime threshold, because the real value of the federal minimum wage has fallen because of the decline of labor unions. There's just been a decline of bargaining power, and there's been just declining standard for workers. And so really what this is kind of getting us back more toward the economy we had back in the 1950s and 60s, where the economy was growing really, really quickly, but everybody was sharing in that growth. So I think that's a big part of the reason why they oppose that. Now, one of the funny things about the reasons why they oppose it is opponents tend to talk out of two sides of their mouth on this. So
you noticed that too?
Yeah, that's right.
I thought it was just me.
You know, I think it may be true. That's why. There's two things they like to do. So the first thing they'll argue is this actually won't really do anything for workers, because what'll happen is employers will reduce workers' base wage, pay them the overtime, so they don't make any more. So if you were getting paid $10, they'll reduce your wage to $8. They'll pay you the time and a half, and you end up, if you're making $40,000 a year, you still make $40,000 a year.
So they're basically assuming, well, employers will find a way around this.
That's right.
They'll just restructure how people are paid so that they don't actually have to pay anyone anymore.
Right. And there definitely will be some of that. Employers are smart. That's why they do that. But on the other hand, they're also saying it's going to raise the cost of workers. It's going to make it, make it harder to, for these small businesses to stay open. Those things are completely contradictory. Either it raises wages, which is raising the price of labor, or it doesn't. So really, they talk out of both sides of their mouth, where they say it's not going to do anything for workers, but for some reason, it's going to raise the costs to employers, which makes no sense. It either does nothing or it does something.
You're being so stubborn about this, Brendan. I feel like it's really unfair of you to assume that people should only make one argument as opposed to two totally inconsistent arguments.
Well,
we'll for the sake of argument, we'll move on to their next.
To be frank, they are doing double the work that way. So, you know, I mean, they are, you know, I don't like to work overtime. Maybe they do.
Are you saying they should be paid overtime
yeah,
for these
right.
kinds of both sides of their mouth arguments? I'm hearing that.
So you could say they're doing an argument and a half.
We're going to title this episode Brendan Duke thinks that Paul Ryan should be paid overtime. But is that okay?
It's creative. It's creative.
So one of the other arguments you hear them make sometimes is that this is going to kill jobs. Is there evidence that that's the case?
No. So first of all, if it doesn't do anything for workers, then there's no way it kills jobs, because it doesn't. The only way they could argue it kills jobs is because it makes it more expensive to hire workers. But if it's not raising the wages, then it doesn't do that. So that's the first thing. Now, set that aside. It actually should create jobs, for the reason that, with the minimum wage, you know, employers have to pay the minimum wage no matter what. With overtime, they actually have an option not to pay a time and a half. That is to hire another worker. So actually, Goldman Sachs and the National Retail Federation, is probably the main opponent of the overtime rule. I look at my Twitter, and they're just spending a ton of money advertising shoddy economic analysis showing that, trying to argue it's a bad thing. So they're spending a ton of money on this. Both of them actually do end up arguing that it will create jobs. For the reason that employers are going to end up hiring more workers. I think that's a good thing, both because we want workers to have jobs, and the second thing is that's actually going to end up raising wages by tightening the labor market, which is what we really haven't seen. So it's really a win-win, and they actually end up arguing it actually is a job creator, according to Goldman Sachs and the retail industry.
Those sound like the kinds of people that conservatives do like to listen to. That's so interesting.
That's right. So basically, we have the retail industry and Goldman Sachs arguing that restoring a measure to its Gerald Ford level is going to create jobs, is basically the overtime debate in a nutshell.
So presumably this is not going to solve the entire problem of economic inequality, which remains at historic heights. Where do we go from here in terms of a broader agenda to try to boost wages and to close the ever-widening gap between the richest and the poorest?
So, yeah, that's a great question. So this is a huge step. This is probably – yesterday was probably the biggest day for workers in the Obama administration. So it is a huge deal. It's so great that they're doing this. It's amazing that they can do it without Congress. So it's a huge deal, but it's definitely not everything. So I like to think that there's basically three reasons why wages have stagnated. So the first group of reasons is the decline of labor standards like overtime and the minimum wage and our failure to adopt new labor standards for our changing economy, things like paid leave, things like regulations to prevent volatile scheduling, that sort of thing. So we've seen a decline of labor standards and the failure to enact labor standards that really prevent a race to the bottom. So that's one group. Another portion is just the decline of labor unions. That's been a big part of that. A lot of studies show that about a third of the rise of wage inequality is a result of the decline of labor unions. We at CAP have done research that about half of the decline of middle class is explained by the decline of labor unions. And we've also done research showing that labor unions increase economic mobility. So labor unions are a huge deal, and their decline has been a big part of the fall in the decline of labor unions has been a big reason for the rise in income inequality. And also it's related to labor standards, which is when you don't have a labor union, you want a minimum wage, you want overtime, because unions get you a lot of those things. And then the third thing is just loose labor markets, high unemployment. It really makes it hard to bargain for a wage for a worker when there's 10 people willing to do their wage to do their job at half the price. Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing, is we need to keep the recovery going and make sure that we have an economy where employers fight for employees rather than vice versa.
Brendan Duke, thank you so much for joining me to talk about the new overtime rule, which was released earlier this week. Where can folks go to learn more about what's in that rule and who it helps?
I think the best place to go is the Economic Policy Institute. It has a lot of resources on their website. www.epi.org has the best information. You can find out how many people are affected in your state, by demographic group, everything you need to know.
Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, Brendan Duke. So we've got a great rest of the episode lined up. We're going to be sitting down talking a little bit with some film producers who have put out a film looking at Paul Ryan and whether he really is the great savior when it comes to poverty that he claims to be, as part of a Sundance social justice film series. Also talking a little bit about Zika, so stay tuned.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. Sundance Films has launched a new project called Take Five, Justice in America, where they give filmmakers 5 minutes to explore an issue that's hot on the agenda for the 2016 election. One of those issues is poverty, and the film is A Hug from Paul Ryan, which follows Tiana Gaines Turner, who's a mother of three, who's faced many barriers to success, and was the only person living in poverty to be allowed to testify at the 2014 Budget Committee hearing on the War on Poverty. Tiana is one of America's working poor and is a member of Witnesses to Hunger, and A Hug from Paul Ryan follows her in the year following her testimony. We're joined by directors Dawn Argott and Sheena Joyce to discuss this more. Thank you so much for joining.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So first, congrats on this film. I've seen it covered in various venues, and it's a really great project. And you know, before we get into the specifics of what you guys did, can you tell me broadly more about what Take Five is?
Yeah, we were approached by the Sundance Now Doc Club. They were launching this new initiative. And obviously, as you said, it's called Justice Take Five in America. And the idea was to have filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, use the short form format to you know, to highlight an issue that they were passionate about and that could really spark a dialogue. That was really all the directive that we were given, that, you know, they wanted these to be conversation starters. They wanted something that was, you know, an issue that we were all kind of collectively dealing with in the culture, and certainly in an election year, to talk about things that were important to us as filmmakers and things that we felt that needed to be addressed. And so the idea of bringing kind of established documentary filmmakers into the mix to, you know, to work in this format, this was a really interesting idea to us. And, you know, we ran with it.
And we're used to making feature-length films, feature-length documentaries. And even though they may have an editorial slant, they're certainly not advocacy pieces, or we try to present as much of a balanced approach as we can. And this was kind of a refreshing opportunity for us to be able to do more of an advocacy piece or have more of our opinion and our voice in it in that way.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned, we've worked with Tiana here on Talk Poverty Radio. So when we saw that she was part of this project, we were really excited. But we were interested in getting your perspective to help us kind of understand the power of filmmaking in advancing the national conversation around poverty. And so how did you guys decide upon sharing her story as part of your way to advance this conversation?
Sure. Well, Don and I live in Center City, Philadelphia, which of the 10 major cities has the highest low poverty rate. So we're living in it. It's around us all the time. And we wanted to focus on the issue of the working poor. For many of us, we are a paycheck away from needing to rely on government assistance to help us get through a tough time. And keeping that in mind, we started to do some research on some stories that were close to home that might highlight the issue.
And, you know, in doing that research and trying to keep it local for us, I mean, obviously you can go to any city and around the country and find similar, you know, stories, but we were looking for a story that was, you know, in the Philadelphia region, that was, you know, in where we live. So upon doing some digging and reaching out to some people that had written on this topic before, we were given a few names. Tiana's was one of the names that came up. And upon more research, the idea that Tiana was the only person living in poverty that was allowed to speak at Paul Ryan's House Budget Committee in 2014, we thought that was a great way to frame a short piece that we can kind of start with. Here we are in 2014, this event happened, and here we are a year later. You know, what, if any, has changed, and kind of check back in and see and talk about the issue through that before and after lens.
And the limitation of a 5-minute piece, on the outset, it seemed exciting for us. We thought, you know, well, we're used to doing features, 90 minutes. This is going to be a piece of cake. And then we really were struck by the challenges of telling a compelling story on a tough issue, a big topic, in 5 minutes. And so we were able to think about it in the sense that, you know what, I can't even describe food stamps in 5 minutes, let alone really talk about the policy issues of the working poor. So how do you get this subject across in an emotional way? And that's just to tell a heartfelt story. And Tiana's story was certainly, for us, the best way to get into the issue quickly and concisely and powerfully and emotionally, without being bogged down by too many of the politics or the details.
And I have to say, as someone, you know, who works in poverty advocacy, there were some key points that you made throughout this short film that I was really impressed that you were able to make, in terms of pointing out that Paul Ryan wants to block grant tons of poverty programs, which essentially would nonpartisan analysts say would cut billions of dollars from assistance that's needed to get people off of poverty. So you're able to really bring those messages through, which was really refreshing for me as an advocate to see. And also, I found myself, again, I said, you know, we've done our own short videos with Tiana. She's been on the show. She's written for our blog. So I know her story very well. But I have to say, I was tearing up towards the end of the video when, you know, she's talking about her experience, right, and not wanting her kids to have to go through what she's going through. You know, what did you all learn from going through this process?
Well, thank you for saying that, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's funny. We had there was an event to kind of launch these short films in New York last week, and the topic came up of humanizing people. And, you know, it's an obvious thing to say that, you know, we need to humanize, make the issue human and make it relatable. But, I mean, that's like life 101 stuff, right?
It's also a little insulting.
Yeah, that you have to humanize somebody living in poverty. It's like,
you shouldn't have to humanize a human,
right,
or put a face to someone. No one should have to be the face of an issue. But that's something you have to address and get past.
Right. So I think that our approach and what we've kind of learned was, you know, that, you know, and it might seem cliche to say, but we're all, you know, we're all going through this together, mm-hmm, right? I mean, that's what, at the end of the day, it's how you connect with people. It's how we live our life. It's how, you know, we kind of live the human experience. It's like we all, you know, we are fortunate that we are, you know, living in poverty, but it's relatable when you're around it because it's not much different. The people that live in poverty don't want anything different than the people that aren't living in poverty. They just want to be able to be happy and live their life and provide for their family and put food on the table for their kids, like basic human needs stuff. So I think, like, it was just a reaffirmation of that, you know, we just have to do better as
human being.
Yeah, as human beings. I mean, I think that coming back to the title of the piece, you know, A Hug from Paul Ryan, it's this idea that there is a human connection there, that just because Paul Ryan, you know, has this position of power, he's not any better than Tiana or me or anybody else that we're not in his position. He just happens to be in this policy position where he gets to, you know, kind of assert his worldview or his, you know, his, you know, what's the right way to say it?
Well, what I would just add is that Tiana says it in the piece. The reason why she gave Paul Ryan a hug instead of a handshake is because that personal connection of grabbing someone and hugging them and hanging on to them, she didn't just want to be heard. She wanted to be seen. She wanted to be felt. She wanted to be remembered. And the beauty, I think, of films and short filmmaking in this piece in particular is you are providing someone an opportunity to be seen and be felt in a way that an article may just portray them as a statistic.
That leads perfectly into my next question, because the film is called A Hug from Paul Ryan. And like you said, when Tiana met him before the 2014 hearing where she testified, he went to shake her hand and she said, no, I want a hug. And it was a deliberate strategy to make it clear that, you know, it's a human connection. You won't, you know, forget me and my face. That was a deliberate strategy. So the hug from Paul Ryan, it seems to be part of the theme throughout this this 5-minute film, is humanizing people,
right,
that are experiencing poverty. So how did you decide to break up the story? Because you go through the first half is the testimony, and then the second half is what's happened since then. What was your strategy for getting that message across?
You know, it was really, this was going back to what Sheena was saying, is how difficult, you know, the process was, because, you know, you realize in a very, you know, you have to lay a foundation on the issue, right? You can't just go into it and be, you know, and try to be all emotional and try to just, like, get into the emotional part of the story, because then you realize that There's no substance there. There's nothing.
Stakes. You've got to set the stakes.
There's nothing for you to kind of rally behind.
Right.
You need to understand in a short amount of time, you know, the issue at stake, and, you know, at least, you know, from the standpoint of her being able to testify, you know, in 2014, that was a big deal. And that, you know, when you start looking at it on a timeline, it's like, well, that's 2 minutes.
Right.
That took 2 minutes. So that means we got 3 minutes left to really, like, get into the meat of the story. That doesn't seem like a whole lot of time. So it's a real – it became very, very difficult to balance the all the things that we wanted to get across in the piece that we felt were just the bare – you know, kind of who, what, why, when, how, you know, all the, you know, journalistic, you know, things that you need to hit upon when you're telling a story. So you just run out of time really, really quickly. So you just, I think this format really forces you to have to pick your spots and really hone in on what you want to say and how to say it as compactly and still not lose. Because the worst thing you do is just put something together that doesn't have any emotion. It's all facts. Mm-hmm. And then you don't want to have anything that's just all emotion and no facts. So it's like you're just trying to constantly, you know, find that balance. And, you know, I hope that we struck that balance, you know, in the most effective way that we could, given what we the time constraints that we were working with.
And as much as it's a film about Tiana, it's also a film about Paul Ryan.
Right.
So his name is in the title. It's broken up and centered around this hearing testimony and whether or not he actually learned anything in the year following it. Why did you guys make that choice? Why didn't you make a film that was just about Tiana? Why did you center it around this particular hearing?
Well, I think that the hearing afforded us, a lens in which to have a before and after, which for a short piece is crucial because, again, you don't have a lot of time. So to be able to kind of, you know, frame this within a year's time, I think is valuable. So you can really start in 2014 and kind of catch up with Tiana in 2015. But I think more importantly that there is the combination, this is a joint issue. This is something that doesn't exist. You know, the politics of the issue and the boots on the ground part of the issue are all kind of one and the same. And I think that the issue in itself needs to be framed with the political discussion.
Right.
Otherwise, it doesn't really do anything. Like,
and Paul Ryan had been chairman of the House Budget Committee in 2014. And then had become Speaker of the House while we were making the piece. And I think that now as Speaker, he has an even higher platform from which to talk about these issues and shape policy. And our point, as Don said, using that hearing to kind of springboard into the issue is that, and the title, is that as much as a hug can display compassion, it can also be an empty gesture. And as kind of what Don was saying, it's up to the policymakers to actually do something to enact change to make people's lives better.
And what do you hope that people who watch this film take away from it?
You know, I think that we just need to do to understand that there is, unfortunately, a big disconnect between government and the people, right? I mean, that's not a new idea or a new thought. But I think in this instance, it's that we do have a voice, and Tiana does have a voice, and she has a powerful story. And it's only when you really get to know, you know, the people that you call the other, the people that you say are, you know, oh, those are the people over there, that when we categorize people as they don't live our life, therefore I can't relate to them. That's why things are kind of are the way they are to a large degree. I mean, the irony in the fact that Tiana was literally the only person living in poverty allowed to speak on the issue of poverty, and all of the other people that are there are policy makers that certainly work with people like Tiana. But why are you listening to the people that kind of that aren't directly affected? And that's again, part of the problem. Like, we have to get back to this direct, you know, we're the constituents, that we have a voice, that what we say matters, and if we want change, that there, that's how it should work. And that's not really how it works anymore. Or maybe it never really did. But I think that there's that feeling of people's stories, and people do count, and people do have a voice, and that voice can affect change, but it has to be heard.
And so what are you hoping is next for this project?
We would just love for this piece to get out. The beauty, from a viewer's standpoint, you know, we spoke about the filmmaker challenge of the issue, but from a viewer's standpoint, it's 5 minutes. Everybody's got 5 minutes. You can give 5 minutes to this film. You can pull out your phone or your laptop or your tablet and watch this in 5 minutes and be moved, and hopefully be moved into action, be moved into being thoughtful about who you are pulling the lever for in the voting booth in the upcoming election, having a greater understanding of the people in your community and your voice as a voter. I hope it just sparks some dialogue that would then lead to change.
The film is called A Hug from Paul Ryan. You can just Google that and find it, or you can we'll have a link to it on along with our show. So, Dawn Argett, Sheena Joyce, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks so much, Tracy.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. Over the past year, the Zika virus, carried by mosquitoes, has caused thousands of severe birth defects in South America. Zika has spread northward to the U.S., where all but 5 states have reported Zika cases. To discuss the potential impact in the U.S., particularly among low-income people in the Gulf Coast, we're joined by Jamila Taylor, a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
So one of the first things that I've thought about when I've heard about Zika is the Ebola cases that were reported on last year. And there was a lot of fear rising in the public and media. And it didn't really turn out to be much of a problem. So is this the same case with Zika? Is this going to be a serious problem in the U.S.?
I would say yes. I mean, I'd like to start by saying that the World Health Organization has declared the spread of Zika virus an international public health emergency. And, you know, since this happened, which was earlier this year, the CDC has been, you know, looking at different studies that have been done on the impact of Zika virus on full communities, but particularly on pregnant women. And what has been found is that, you know, for pregnant women who contract Zika, there's between a 1 to 30% chance that they're fetuses will, you know, get the congenital brain defect known as microcephaly. And so in terms of the threat in the United States, we're seeing that there could be a particular concentration of transmission in the southern states, which is a real problem because we know that in the South, you know, access to basic health care can be an issue, particularly for low-income communities. And I think anytime you have a public health threat such as this on communities that already don't have access to basic health care, we could see a real issue. I think another thing with Zika is that the focus or the dialogue around the issue has really been targeted to the funding issue, the funding fight that we're seeing in Congress right now. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later, but we're not really focused on the fact that it could be a real problem in the South. And I think that's something that we need to be focused on.
So help me understand a bit more, how exactly does the Zika virus spread? I know it's carried by mosquitoes, but what really is going on the ground? What can we expect and what are the impacts? So you mentioned this particular birth defect, but just break it down for me, how this is spread and how pregnant women and their unborn children are impacted.
So Zika is primarily spread through bites from mosquitoes. But I mean, we also know that it can be spread from through sexual transmission from male to partner. And, you know, the threat or the issue that we could see in the South is the fact that, you know, coming into the summer months, the temperature is going to change. We're going to see warmer temperatures. Also, mosquitoes thrive in environments where there is standing water. And that could be a real issue, particularly for communities or people working outside. This is a real issue, particularly for low-wage workers. They tend to work in jobs that keep them outside for longer periods of time. And I think also for low-income families that may not have window screens or door screens in their homes, they could be at higher risk for Zika transmission in terms of getting bites from mosquitoes. So that's one aspect of the issue. And so for pregnant women or women who are even trying to become pregnant, this could be a real issue because we know that through studies that have been shown, particularly in countries like Brazil and others, that pregnant women who had contracted Zika ended up having babies that had microcephaly, which is a congenital brain defect. And so there are clear studies that have shown there's a linkage between Zika transmission in pregnant women and microcephaly in their infants.
And so what does that mean for the child? What are the long-term effects of microcephaly?
Well, the long-term effects really include and children with microcephaly, they're born with smaller heads, and so it means that there's an issue there with their brain growth. The brain growth is slow, and in the long term, it could lead to developmental disabilities.
And so I am not pregnant. I'm not trying to get pregnant currently, mm-hmm. but if I were to somehow contract the Zika virus, how long would that, do we know how long that would stay in my system if that would have any potential impacts if and when I choose to have a child?
I think as long as, you know, for people that are not pregnant or trying to become pregnant, testing, there are testing efforts that are being ramped up across the country. So you want to definitely make sure you get tested. The thing about Zika is that it's easy to, you know, treat. It's not a real problem for people that, you know, are generally healthy, can get tested and get treated for it. The real issue that we see in terms of the seriousness and the longer term effects are really focused on pregnant women. And then I think also, as I mentioned earlier, the issues around low income communities that may not have access to testing, that may not even know how to recognize the symptoms. They may not even know what Zika is. I mean, I think that's another issue too, right? That, you know, regular people in this country sort of working day to day with other demands may not even really know that Zika is a threat to them. And so I will say that the CDC is doing more to make sure that they're working with states to roll out plans to make sure their education efforts, testing is ramped up. And then at the same time, we want to continue to do research on Zika and hopefully find a vaccine.
So you're talking a bit about how low-income people are particularly vulnerable. You said they tend to have jobs where they're working outside. They might not have screen doors. Another thing that popped in my head is I've done some work around climate change and the impact of on low-income people. And I know that something like 1 in 5 low-income people don't have an air conditioner. Mm-hmm. So that might mean, you know,
that's
maybe they're going to have their windows open in the summer months mm-hmm. to have better airflow, or they can't maybe afford the cost of the electricity it takes to run an air conditioning. So obviously there's a lot of ways in which they're particularly vulnerable. What are local leaders doing? Are there any best practices so far on how to help these communities with public education or even prevention?
Well, I will say that, you know, local communities are taking the lead from the White House, who, you know, along with the request for $1.9 billion to address the Zika issue domestically and globally. There was also a plan put into place for different agencies and departments to address the issue. Some of those plans include, as I said earlier, increasing testing. Research is a very important aspect of that so we can find a vaccine. And in terms of the states, they have plans to implement better testing, you know, outreach to pregnant women that may be accessing healthcare through WIC clinics and other social services. Also making sure that for pregnant women who choose to continue with their pregnancies, making sure that they're linked up with social services. But the sort of linchpin, you know, in this issue is the fact that states have not been able to fully implement or roll out their plans because they do not have the funding to do so. And that's why it's really important for, you know, adequate funding to be appropriated so it can be dispersed to the states. So they can address the issue head on.
And I know you said that for women who choose to continue their pregnancies, so obviously there are women who might choose to terminate their pregnancies. Mm-hmm. How is that option? Obviously, we've seen a lot of threats to women's right to choose to have an abortion. How is that playing into this?
Well, I will say that you know, for all women, the decision to terminate a pregnancy is a difficult one, right? And, you know, looking at the CDC estimation, particularly in the southern states, right now there is not a good situation in terms of, you know, real access to abortion care. In some of the states, you know, in most of those states, there are actually restrictions on abortion in the first trimester. There are about 5 states that do have exceptions for fetal anomalies, so it could be available for women there. But, you know, in terms of the work that the CAP is doing around this issue, you know, we're supporting the full spectrum of reproductive and maternal health care for women. So, you know, not only comprehensive access to, you know, prenatal and postnatal care and social supports for women that want to continue with those pregnancies, but we also want to stress the fact that if a woman does make the difficult decision to terminate her pregnancy, then abortion should be made available to her. Safe abortion should be made available to her.
So obviously we're talking a lot about pregnant women since they're the most vulnerable,
right,
to this virus, but like you said, this is something that in addition to being spread from mosquitoes, is also spread from men to their sexual partners.
Right.
Do you feel like a lot of the messages out there, the public education, is failing to target men?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I've uncovered with, you know, the research that I've done in this issue is the fact that there are, you know, Zika kits is what they're being called, that are being provided to targeted communities. And those kits do include condoms. But again, there needs to be more information about, you know, contraceptives and counseling for contraceptives, right? I think both men and women need to be engaging on how to have safer sex. And then for women who, you know, do not wish to become pregnant, you know, having access to the contraceptives of their choice. So it is an issue. And I've also been advocating for female condoms. I mean, there hasn't, anything that I've sort of seen on the issue has not included a conversation around female condoms. And I think that women should also, you know, have a method of choice to be used themselves. But there hasn't been a lot of messaging around men. We've seen a lot of, or not a lot, we've seen messages come out basically telling women, particularly in the Latin American countries who, you know, have really seen a strong presence of Zika, that women shouldn't have sex, you know, for a couple of years, you know, they shouldn't have children, but no focus on men and telling them what not to do. And that's typically what we see, right?
Right. I was going to say,
when these things happen,
where there's women's bodies are
right,
subject to it, it's just, we'll stop having sex and we're not going to talk about men, what their role is, and how
safe sex is a possibility.
Right, absolutely.
Or even just even the role of sexual assault in these sorts of things.
Absolutely.
That sometimes women's sexual encounters are not of their choice or not
right.
consensual. Mm-hmm. The conversation really does have to include men and just greater protections. This is, you know, goes beyond health. It just goes goes beyond just focusing on women to a comprehensive conversation
right.
about consent, about women's access to the full range of reproductive health, like you said. It's just, yeah, it seems like a really important issue. One thing that is important to note is it seems to be slightly bipartisan.
yes.
I should say, I was reading a quote from Marco Rubio that said mm-hmm. that, you know, addressing Zika is not a Democratic issue or Republican issue. It's something that's necessary, but that doesn't mean that things are going smoothly in Congress. So as you mentioned, Obama has requested, or the White House has requested $1.9 billion, mm-hmm. to address the range of services that you've been discussing. What's going on with that?
So right now, as you mentioned, you know, the president has requested $1.9 billion, and Congress has to approve that funding. But what we're seeing is, you know, a type of political wrangling almost around funding for Zika, which I will say with the caveat is bigger than Zika. I mean, it has to do with relationships, I think, you know, or attitudes towards the president and, you know, his agenda. But as you said, you know, this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. I mean, we know that this is a public health concern that could really have endemic proportions in this country. And so now is not the time to play political football. So the situation in the Congress is this. In the House, there has been a funding package that has been introduced. It includes $622 million to address a Zika response, which is about a third of what the president is asking for. Clearly not enough money to address this issue. And on the Senate side, there is a package that has been introduced that includes $1.1 billion, which is a little bit closer to what the president is asking, but still falls short of that request. We want to make sure that we have enough funding to help states roll out their plans in an adequate way to ensure that all people have access to the services they need, particularly low-income people and pregnant women that are, you know, at increased risk for Zika virus.
So what is that exactly is the justification for the lower funding? Because obviously it's positive that there's action. Usually there's, you know, we see inaction as a way of stunting Obama's plans.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something, again, that is impacting a lot of districts that are Republican districts that are going to be vulnerable to this.
Right.
So what's the justification of the underfunding? Is this just a typical, you know, we don't want big government, or, you know, what exactly is the justification?
Well, the justification that's being said publicly is the fact that, you know, there was a lot of money, you know, appropriated to address Ebola, and some of that money is left over. And so why don't we pull some of that funding from Ebola, you know, and other monies that have been unused for different programs and put it towards Zika, you know, which is part of, I think, a principle of the leadership in Congress, right? You know, not having government overreach and cutting back on spending and all of that, which I understand. But this, again, this is a public health concern that could be a real issue in the United States. We've already seen it, you know, sort of ravage communities, particularly low-income communities and communities of color in the global South. And so it could be a real problem here as well.
And the cases have been already reported, and we still haven't done anything. And Josh Earnest, he had a great way of just kind of slapping Congress when he said, you know, the House of Representatives is 3 months late and more than a billion short. I think that's just a very blunt way of putting it.
Absolutely. It is a blunt way of putting it. And to be honest, when I saw the $622 million number, I mean, I just was floored. You know, to me, I feel like the audacity to, you know, appropriate or try to appropriate that level of funding to address this issue is laughable.
And so one thing that was, I think, really puts this lack of funding into perspective is that a coalition of organizations that focus on health sent a letter around to Congress, mm-hmm. and it's led by the March of Dimes, and they pointed out that our nation can expect a cost of approximately $10 million in lifetime costs for care of each affected baby. Mm-hmm. So any child that has birth defects or cognitive impairment as a relation to the Zika, it will cost $10 million. And this will largely be costs borne by the government, mm-hmm. and Medicaid programs specifically. So Medicaid, which is crucial to low-income people, and a lot of states have foregone, you know, Medicaid expansion. This is going to be a cost that, if we're not addressing this seriously, it's going to be a lifetime cost to the government. Mm-hmm. What goes into the lifetime treatment of children? This $10 million,
yeah.
do you know what this kind of is part of this?
I don't know fully, you know, what the $10 million number was factored into that. But what I do want to say is that there are going to be costs outside of those that are, you know, going to be covered by the government. For a low-income family to, have a child with disabilities, you know, we're talking about people that are already sort of steeped in poverty, right? I mean, this is only going to deepen the cycle of poverty for them. That's why social supports are very important. But I also think that in the context of thinking about what the government will have to sort of pay or contribute to the lifetime of care that, you know, these children will need, we also need to be talking about the impact on the families and what that means for a lifetime of care.
I think that's a great point, because the $10 million, it sounds like, is just talking about health
right.
impacts, but it doesn't talk about foregone wages for
right.
know, any family members who have to take time off from work to care for these individuals, or the losses to the economy if they're not able to fully work and participate.
Access to childcare is another big issue for families across the country, particularly for low-wage families. There are tons of supports. We haven't even really begun to sort of dig into this as much as we need to. It's great that we're having this conversation today and we're talking about the potential of Zika, the impact on low-income families, and that hasn't been a part of the conversation domestically. So much attention is being taken away from what we need to be doing to make sure women and families have access to testing and the care that they need. It's been focused on Congress and, you know, sort of the squabbling around funding.
So it seems like Zika is almost, I was going to say, a perfect case study. It's an unfortunate case study that highlights the lack of services and lack of comprehensive health care. It's really bringing to light a lot of the shortcomings that low-income people will face.
Absolutely.
Well, Jamila Taylor, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, thank you so much for joining us. You know, what can we expect in the coming weeks with regard to funding this package to prevent and address Zika?
Well, I think what we can expect to see in terms of the Hill is the fact that we have two, you know, funding proposals on the table. You know, if they both passed in the respective chambers, they will have to go to conference and sort of hash out a number that works for both chambers. At the same time, we also have the White House continuing to push for, you know, the full funding. So I think for us, really keeping our eye towards what's happening around the funding issue, but also doing what we can to help states implement plans that are mindful of the impact that this could have on low-income communities in particular, definitely having some targeted outreach, targeted testing, targeted service provision, I think is going to be important. So we'll continue to track what's happening. And I think here at CAP also doing research and putting out, you know, good data and analysis on the potential impact for Zika on communities that are particularly vulnerable.
Well, we'll be following along, and Jamila's going to have a great piece out soon on talkpoverty.org, as well as a great report diving into this. So we look forward to having you back on the show soon.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.